you know, we have all of these trade agreements, and what have they actually meant economically?
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seed? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
I mean, starting off on the on what the right wing says is what works and why these trade agreements are so important. So we demolish those myths, and then we go on to what they actually do.
We're talking about trade deals with the NDP trade critic, that Peter Julian. He's back in his riding because it's close to Christmas when we're doing this interview.
Hi, Maggie. Good to be with you.
Thanks, Peter. There's a lot of things going wrong with some of the trade deals, and I'm going to ask Peter to just outline some of the problems that maybe Hamiltonians have already felt and know, but there's more to come, I think.
Well, thanks, Maggie. Yeah, there's a lot of myths around these trade deals that Canada has been signing, and I think the important thing to start off with is to say that Canada has the worst trade template in the world, and we'll come back to that a little bit later on when we talk about the Canada-European trade agreement and why some Europeans are increasingly concerned. But we have a bad trade template. It's a very, very right-wing, neoliberal attempt to impose the kinds of right-wing standards that most Canadians reject. So the question is, really, when you've got these trade bureaucrats and right-wing politicians that promote these trade agreements, are they actually doing what these right-wingers say that these trade agreements are supposed to do? And the evidence actually points to the fact that they don't. What we've had over the last 20 years, and that's the most, I think, most important point to start, is what we inevitably hear from right-wing politicians, from trade bureaucrats, from big business lobbyists, is that these trade agreements have brought us unprecedented prosperity. That's
right.
The words that they most normally use.
Prosperity,
right?
And jobs.
Yeah, and when we look at what's actually happened to middle class and poor Canadians, over the last 20 years, we've seen a hollowing out. Middle class families are earning less. They've had their real wages pushed down, even though they're working longer and longer hours and harder than ever. And as well, for poor Canadians, we've seen a real gutting. Their wages, their family income has been pushed down. So what's actually happened over the past 20 years, instead of having an evenly distributed prosperity, is we're seeing a redistribution of income towards the wealthiest members of society. And the wealthiest Canadians have seen their income skyrocket. They've they've gone up by over a third in real terms over the past 20 years. So what we're seeing now is the wealthiest of Canadians taking most of the Canadian income pie. It's a kind of a reverse Robin Hood. What they're doing is stealing from the middle class and the poor and redistributing all of that income towards the wealthiest of Canadians, those who need that income the least.
That's right. Well, Hamilton alone, look how many jobs we were promised with international trade deals. Look how many of the plants are closed.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And the impact particularly strong on the youngest of Canadians. What we've seen is a number of things happen over the past 20 years with these trade agreements and all the right-wing conservative-style economic policies that go with them. The starting wages now in the job markets are lower than they've been in decades. Student debt's at record levels, and most jobs that these right-wingers have managed to create, they've gutted all the good jobs, the good manufacturing jobs, as you say, the good jobs that were family sustaining. What they've replaced them with is the poor paying burger flipping jobs. And as a result, for youngest of Canadians, they now go on the job market. They have lower wages than we've seen in generations. They have high levels of student debt if they've gone on to college or post-secondary education, highest levels of student debt in our history as a country. And they get jobs that don't have pensions and don't have benefits. So if you look at the what we've done, it's a profound mortgage on the future of younger Canadians, whether they're in Hamilton or anywhere else in the country. They're going to earn less to pay off high levels of debt that they will take decades, if they're lucky, to pay off. And at the end of their working life, they can't even look forward to a pension anymore because the jobs that these conservative party and liberal party economic policies create don't end up with any pensions at the end of the line either. And so when we look at the so-called economic prosperity, it's economic prosperity for a tiny minority of Canadians. For a lawyer or a corporate CEO, you're doing better than you ever have in the history of our country, but everybody else is doing worse.
Right. 1%, as Linda McQuaig says in her new book, The Trouble with Billionaires. The other thing I've noticed is just following the path of Harper, Stephen Harper, whenever he makes a trade deal, you say he's using the same template.
Yeah.
And seeing the results, it's been 20 years. So has he not, I know he's not very communicative with the press, and he does these deals mostly out of eyesight and hearing of the public, finds a way to make these deals happen when we can't find access to them, which is one of the troubling things, and that's a constant I've seen as a pattern. But doesn't he by now see the damage that some of these previous deals have done to Canadians?
Well, no, because it's not about, it's certainly not about economic prosperity. That's the first thing. I think we've adequately demonstrated that by just talking about what's happened to real family income. And it's not even about exports. And we'll come back to that in a moment, Maggie. But that's an incredible contradiction as well when we talk about the export figures after we've signed these free trade deals. What it is about pushing a hard right-wing ideology. And liberals and conservatives love doing this. They can't do it in the public domain. The kinds of right-wing, they're wingnut, wacko policies that are covered by these trade agreements, if the Liberal or Conservative Party went public in an election and said, this is what we're going to do, people wouldn't vote for them. So what they've done is they've outsourced these hard right wing economic policies and put them in these trade agreements. And then what they say is, well, oh, you know, we can't do anything about that because our trade agreements don't permit us to put in place the kinds of progressive policies that most Canadians want. It's a very deliberate attempt to mislead the public by putting these hard right wing trade policies in place in an effort to say, well, the government can't do anything about this.
Exactly.
Because the trade agreement doesn't allow us to do this.
Exactly. And now I think he's referring to the NAFTA trade agreement. In one speech I heard him say, our hands are tied when it comes to the agreements. He cited chapter 18, I think it was, from FTA.
Yeah. I'd like to just talk a little bit more about the economic impacts, if you don't mind,
sure.
Because I think that's important. And when we talk about all these lower wages, and particularly among the youth, then you have to see what the net result is. And when the Governor of the Bank of Canada talked about excessive debt levels of the average Canadian family, that is exactly because of the fact that they've been driving down Canadians' wages, that the average Canadian family now has record levels of debt. In fact, the debt load has doubled over the past 20 years in real terms for the average Canadian family. So what's happening is Canadian families are working harder and harder, they're getting paid less and less, and they're taking on more and more debt just to make ends meet. And this is a direct result of the economic policies, including the trade policies, that Liberal and Conservative governments have brought in.
Exactly.
And this is something that Canadians need to be aware of, that
sure.
These trade and economic policies are designed to make the wealthy extremely wealthy and to make most of us very poor. So when we talk about free trade, the name free trade is an oxymoron. It's trade that comes, these free trade agreements come at a tremendous cost to the middle class and to poor Canadians right across Canada.
Can you give us an example of one trade deal from sort of start to finish, the result of it on Canadians or a Canadian company?
Well, I'll just look at, I can give you the what we've uncovered, and this is something that we couldn't even get from the Minister of International Trade. We asked for months and months to get the actual export figures in real terms after we've signed particularly these bilateral trade agreements, mm-hmm. and the Ministry of International Trade would never provide it. What they do is they provide figures that are done in, they're not done in real terms, so what happens is they show an evolution of trade, but based on inflation devalued dollars. Of course, as we all know, I mean, your dollar's not worth the same from year to year, so if you try to pretend that dollars in 2010 are worth exactly the same as dollars in 2000, that would be really misleading to people. But that's what the trade ministry does. It gives figures pretending that dollars in 2010 are worth exactly the same as dollars in 2000. And we said, well, no, you've got to have dollars that have the same value, and that's the only way to determine whether our exports are going up and down. The trade ministry never provided these to us, so we had to work through Statistics Canada and the Library of Parliament, and we got the figures back and exposed them to the country. Now, the big media, of course, isn't willing to publish these figures because they're very controversial. What it does is undermine the entire basis of this right-wing approach to trade. But what has really happened when you look at the real figures is that our exports have gone down in virtually every market mm-hmm. where we've signed a free trade agreement. The exports from that country to Canadian markets have gone up in virtually every case, but in Canada, with one exception, after signing trade deals, our exports to those markets have gone down. In some cases, they've varied. They've gone down, they've gone up, they've gone down, they've gone up. In some cases, over time, they may have come back to the same levels they were before we signed the agreement. But in every single case, they did go down after signature, which shows that these trade agreements aren't about exports. They're not about building markets, that there's something profoundly dysfunctional about Canada's trade policy. When you sign a trade deal, and our exports to those markets go down, you have to ask the question, then what are these trade deals doing?
We aren't building more factories. We aren't making more jobs. We're not, you know, I don't know if they're outsourcing labor or what they're saying, but there's no labor.
Yes, they're outsourcing labor big time. Hamilton and other areas of southern Ontario and across this country have been impacted by loss of 500,000 good manufacturing jobs. These are family-sustaining jobs. These are the kind of jobs that our parents were able to have and to raise families with. And instead, they've replaced them with burger-flipping minimum-wage jobs that people can't raise families with. And then we wonder... And the big media companies that support these incredibly asinine trade agreements with a hard right-wing agenda, and the big media companies wonder why there's 300,000 people seeping out in the streets and parks of our country, and why families are carrying record levels of debt, and why so many families are living basically week to week and could lose their home or lose the roof over their heads if they get laid off or they get their hours reduced. I mean, we're talking about economic inequality and economic mm-hmm. precarity like we haven't lived through since the 1920s.
That's right.
Takes us back to before the Great Depression. Right. CBC or CTV, and you listen to the radio and you read the newspapers, it's as if they are completely oblivious to what is actually happening in
most
Canadian lives.
Well, you get little bits, but you don't get an understanding. George Soros is a good source introductory source for finding out what is wrong with those, he calls them market fundamentalism deals and market fundamentalism economics. There are so many people in Ontario that are homeless. It's not a secret anymore that something's really functionally wrong with Canadian government, with what's wrong with the trade deals, the job deals, foreign ownership that comes in. They sign whatever agreements, but they don't seem to stick to them, and nobody seems to care. As you said, Harper says, well, I'm stuck with these previous agreements, and I think he's referring to NAFTA, previous agreements where I can't pull the strings loose from these deals. You know, I can't step in and stop them. Well, that's what the government is supposed to do, is to give a safety barrier for its own citizens against corporate rule and corporate gluttony in their own country. But Harper's busy talking about starting jobs for mid-sized businesses or smallest businesses in some other country in the world. It's like, Does he think he's prime minister of the world and he's trying to help some other small third world country? We are a third world country now.
In terms of income inequality, we've turned the clock back generations, and that's absolutely undoubtable when you look at the real figures about what's really going on. And the other aspect, of course, which mirrors, as you say, Maggie, the sort of third world economy, is we're shipping record levels mm-hmm. of raw resources out of the country. Now that yep. means raw bitumen, that means raw logs in British Columbia, Northern Ontario. It means that the resources, Canada being one of the wealthiest countries in the world for our natural resources, Canadians aren't profiting from that because we're shipping them out.
That's right.
So that cheap labor elsewhere can, there are a few jobs available, but at much lower wages. And then a few investors on Bay Street in Toronto reap all of the benefits
That's
of
right.
the resources that we have in our country. And this is why I think more and more Canadians are saying there's something fundamentally wrong. When one of the richest countries on the world is getting poorer and poorer, as far as the middle class is concerned, as far as poor Canadians is concerned, what we're seeing is massive income redistribution and Canadians having to scrape just mm-hmm. to make ends meet, land of plenty.
We're being massively deprived of our basic rights to live, to eat, to have housing. I refer to that as domicide, when something's done purposefully that makes its citizens become homeless. It's just the same as a genocide. It's just a different word for it. We were never, ever thinking about allowing foreign companies to own our trees, to own our water, to own, well, the mineral resources. And it's been going on since the 1980s or longer. It's been planned since the 1960s. It's a constant with, well, if you follow Harper's path and his connections, and you include the Liberals in this as well, because the trade deals are the same, and you said it's a template that they're both using.
Yeah.
The template, can you explain that template in a way that anybody will understand how it works? I think people understand how it doesn't work, but explain to them why Harper thinks that this is a good template.
Well, and this gets us into a bit of the debate now around the Canada-European trade agreement, because one of the worst aspects of the trade template in Canada is the so-called investor state provisions. Now, what that means is basically for any government or state decision that's made, and that can be a national government decision, it could be a provincial government decision, it could be a municipal government decision, the corporations now have the right to sue in their own sort of corporate courts and get compensation from the taxpayer if in any way their right to profit is impeded. It doesn't even mean that the company has had any of its properties expropriated or any of its properties in any way impacted. All they have to do is suggest that in some way their profits have been impeded and they can sue Canadian taxpayers. Now, of course, that has an impact not only on when policy, environmental policy or social policy is brought in. It also means that the natural democratic sense of checks and balances that a city council in Hamilton or the Ontario provincial government or Canada's parliament can make a decision, and if it's in the best interest of the people, then that decision then is implemented. With these investor state provisions, a corporate CEO now has the ability to say, oh, you want to bring this in? Well, you're going to have to pay us first.
That's
and
right.
What we're seeing is the corporate sector is now using this in a very, very big way. And I'll give you two examples if you like, Maggie. First, we have Ethel Corporation. Now, Ethel Corporation is a corporation that manufactured a neurotoxin, a gasoline additive called MMT. And no one questioned the health impacts. This is a horribly toxic product. And the Canadian government said, well, we're going to have to ban this product, of course, because it has impacts right down the line, health and safety impacts on children, on pregnant women, on Canadians generally. Well, FL Corporation got $13 million from Canadian taxpayers and the people listening on our program today and Canadians right across the country as compensation for manufacturing a bad product that the government then banned. It's ludicrous when you think about it. Let's say somebody robs a bank. That's the equivalent. They break the law. They rob a bank, and it's the equivalent of the government and taxpayers having to compensate that person because the government said, well, no, you're going to have to go to jail for robbing that bank.
Yeah.
This is what the corporate sector now gets. No matter how egregiously bad their product, they can seek compensation if it impacts on their company profits in any way.
Yep.
And let me give you another example more recently. Abitibi Bullwater, which is this company in Newfoundland and Labrador that has had longstanding timber and water rights in Newfoundland and Labrador in exchange, because those are rights that are granted by the people of Newfoundland and Labrador.
Right.
They got these rights in exchange for operating a mill. Well, the company changed its owners. Some new company owners decided that they didn't want to keep their end of the bargain anymore, and they shut down the mill, throwing everybody out of work. And the Newfoundland and Labrador legislature made the decision that they were going to withdraw their timber and water rights. I mean, that was part of the deal that the company had signed. So it made absolutely eminent sense for the legislature, the people of Newfoundland and Labrador, through their elected representatives, to say, well, you're not keeping your end of the bargain, so we're taking back the rights that we temporarily gave you in exchange for operating that mill. Abitibi Bullwater then used the same provisions, these investor state provisions that are in Chapter 11 of NAFTA, and said, no, we're gonna sue you now, because even though you're making a decision in the public interest, in some way you're impeding our profits. So
mm-hmm.
The taxpayers, again, the people listening and right across, Canadians right across the country, had to cough up $130 million in compensation to Abitibi Bullwater for not keeping their end of the commitment that they had made. The company broke its word and gets money from Canadian taxpayers in exchange for doing that. It's absurd. It's absolutely outrageous. Yet this is what is contained in every single one of the...
Well, the NAFTA ideas, it started with Brian Mulroney with the FTA, was built into NAFTA.
Yes.
Nobody wants to untie those strings because why?
Well, because the right-wing politicians like the fact that their corporate buddies get money anytime a government makes a decision in the best interest of the people. It's like a democratic override. From now on, whenever governments at any level do anything, they are subject to somebody walking up and with their hand out saying, you want to do this, you want to protect the environment, you want to... establish social housing, you want to establish an effective job market in Hamilton, well, you're going to have to pay us first. And it's absurd. No other country in the world has it as part of their trade template. After NAFTA, in fact, the United States government moved right away from investor state rights and has subjected the ability to seek compensation by companies to a whole range of things that come first. For example, environmental protection, health and safety measures, the public interest, all of those come first. So if those are the things that are behind a government decision, you can't sue the U.S. government. You can sue Canadian governments for anything. It's just a blank check for corporate CEOs. And, of course, corporate CEOs, they're not thinking in the public interest. They're thinking of themselves. And if they can get easy money out of the Canadian taxpayer, they'll do that. Just to finish off on Abitibi Bullwater, because
okay.
This is one of the most outrageous things.
Right.
Abitibi Bullwater shouldn't even have been able to use this clause, because it's supposed to protect foreign investors. It's
right.
A Canadian company. So what they did is they used a mailbox in Delaware and said, oh, we're a company in the United States now,
yeah.
And used that to shake down Canadian taxpayers for $130 million, and conservatives and liberal MPs support that 100%. It's outrageous, and these are the kinds of things which is why so many people around the world look at the Canadian trade template And they are aghast that we have turned over our whole trade agenda to these incredibly right-wing, mean-spirited provisions that do nothing for the public interest or the public good.
It has to come out. I know Danny Williams out there, he tried to stop it. He got some news coverage. How do we stop it? How does the citizen, the working person or the unworking person stop it? I mean, shows like mine help to get it out to many different universities so that people can hear, okay, here's what's going on. Here's what's happening with these trade deals. Here's the template. Here's how it's set up so that we can't win no matter what. We can't fight back no matter what. How do we stop it then?
Well, by standing up, and we've stopped a number of these agreements and these negotiations. Most recently, the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Now, that was something that was brought in by George Bush and the Liberals, and then Stephen Harper, of course, supported it. Now, I was at a public meeting that was sponsored down in Hamilton by the three hardworking Hamilton MPs, and they did a terrific terrific job of sponsoring a public meeting. It was a standing room only crowd there. And what we saw is that people were willing to speak up and they were willing to come out.
Who was the press that was attending that meeting?
I don't recall who the media were. I do recall that as a follow-up, a lot of people were writing in to local papers, and
okay.
and the fact that Hamiltonians got involved, as well as many other Canadians right across mm-hmm. the country, did make a difference, and we were able to stop that agenda, working with our allies in the United States and Mexico. But there's an example of a situation where the fact that people were willing to speak out made a difference. And so it's I think a case where we all have to speak out. We all have to get organized. We are winning I'd say more and more of these battles, but it's the fact that people are willing to get involved.
Well, they have to. They have no choice now.
Yeah.
Their job was promised to them, their pensions were promised to them and then there's a buyout and everybody is promising, you know, continuation of job and pension and benefits for health. And within weeks they lose it and there doesn't seem to be any help from their government. So what else can they do?
Yeah. Just to give you an example, Chris Charlton and David Christopherson and Wayne Marston, the three Hamilton MPs that sponsored this SPP meeting, they've been very active in the House of Commons, and they certainly need the support of folks from the Hamilton area. So when people contact their office and say, we're concerned about the Canada-European trade agreement and the negotiations, that helps to bolster the work that they are all doing in the House of Commons, and they're all doing a magnificent job. And I think people are not—they're not impartial to this, as you know. When members of Parliament, like Chris and David and Wayne, speak out, people need to support them because mm-hmm. it's them speaking out on behalf of their constituents that helps make the difference in turning the tide on these economic policies and trade policies that have such a negative impact on
people's
lives.
Well, they're keeping it in the public eye, and that's the biggest important thing, because CPAC has to run those shows of what's going on in Parliament. So that is an important thing, to keeping it in the discussion mode rather than behind the closed doors mode. And I can't believe that Harper's managed to continually, time after time, repeatedly do these deals in a way that makes it not public. He's just done deals with India. I don't know what to say when he says this will bring prosperity and business between the two countries. I'm not sure exactly what he thinks is going to happen. I don't see much benefit for Canadians, and I haven't read the details of that.
Well, they're just in initial stages, fortunately. But getting back to these so-called investor state provisions, these Chapter 11 provisions, my concern would be that they would be in an eventual agreement with India. And with the Canada-European trade agreement, this is the problem. What the government is doing is putting our public services on the line. What they're saying to European corporations is you can access our public services, our public health care, our public water provisions. And the problem with all of that, once we give all of that access, is then if we realize that this is bad policy, that we don't want to have private European water companies operating our water supplies. And I'll come back to what some of the impacts have been on that in a moment. The investor state provisions mean that if we realize it's a bad policy, then we have to pay out hundreds of millions of dollars, or if not billions of dollars, in compensation to these same companies. That's the fundamental problem.
So it's blackmail.
What they're trying to do. These extreme right-wingers, these market fundamentalists, as you call them, and I think that's a very apt term, what they're trying to do is make it impossible for progressive policies to be brought forward. The trade agreements, because they're not for exports, as we've seen, and they're certainly not for economic prosperity, as we've seen. I mean, the proof of that is what the results have been over the last 20 years. Since they're not about that, what they are about is making sure that our right to ensure food sovereignty, our right to have environmental stewardship, to put in place effective social programs, to have in common managed for the public good, our water systems, our healthcare system, our public services. What it's designed to do is ensure that none of those things can be put into place again. I mean, if we had these trade agreements in place, we never would have had Medicare. And what these extreme right-winger market fundamentalists are trying to do is making it possible for governments to do things in the best interest of their citizens.
So they're interfering with the way we govern our country. Isn't there something we can do in that area?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things that we can do is make sure we're supporting the work of members of parliament who want to change that. I would suggest, and people might consider it a bit partisan, but the NDP has been the only champions in the House of Commons that has actively worked to ensure that our governments actually have the ability to make decisions in the interests of its citizens, of us, all of us as Canadians. So I would suggest get involved with the NDP. If we sit on our hands, if we don't get involved, what will happen over time as these agreements are brought forward one after the other is ensuring that our future generations will not be able to put in place the social programs and the public services that helped change things in the 1920s and 30s. I mean, we had profound income inequality in the 1920s and 30s. And what happened is the CCF, the NDP's predecessor party, got active, the labor movement got active, farmers' movements got active,
right.
And we changed how we were governed as a people. We put in place pensions and unemployment insurance. We put in place public health care. We put in place all of those mechanisms to ensure more equality and a safety net for Canadians. And what these right-wingers have discovered is, well, they can't win a democratic debate on these issues because Canadians support these policies. So what they're suggesting they've got to do is take the ability of government to make these decisions away. And that's what these trade agreements are really all about.
Mm-hmm.
If they were about trade and promoting exports, they'd be taking a different approach, a fair trade approach. And that's what we've been saying all along. We're fair traders. The NDP is in working with fair traders around the world. We're bringing forward fair trade legislation in the spring. We've been very clear about what we do support. Tariff reduction, yes, we support, provided that we have the right transition strategies in place. But this is not about tariff reduction. This is not about promoting exports. This is about a right-wing agenda that these right-wingers, these market fundamentalists, want to put into place.
So I have to interject here that a lot of these issues do have a very strong relationship with the grassroots groups, and those are the ones that get things happening. They get events happening, organizations happening on the street, because the people on the street are the ones that feel the end result of all of these economic policies. The poor always feel it. They're on the street. There are other groups, the Green Group, they have some similar agendas. Needs to be a little bit more power going around besides just the Liberals and the Conservatives. And I know that you're supporting the NDP. I support the NDP's views as well. But I would like to say, and I have to say this as a broadcaster, that there are some other groups like the Bloc and the Green Party that carry similar, well, I hope the Bloc does, carry similar ideals and will help you with the fight of attacking and keeping pressure and keeping an open light on the Liberals and the Conservatives.
Yeah, I wish I could say that the Bloc members of Parliament are supportive. Unfortunately, they haven't been on these kinds of issues. And I say similar things in Quebec when I speak in French on French radio, that I say to folks that they need to talk to their local members of Parliament, including Bloc members of Parliament, so that they can be educated. A lot of times, the members of Parliament drink the Kool-Aid. They are told that this is all about exports. They don't go any further to actually do their due diligence and find out what is actually happening on the ground.
That's right.
And as a result of this, I think it's easy for them to say, oh, gee, you know, I've got these powerful lobbyists saying this is good. It must be good. And you have to go beyond that. So
that's why they need pressure on them all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You are right to say that there are many other individuals in the broader movement that are active in this. The Council of Canadians, of course. I used to be the National Executive Director and worked with Maude Barlow, and I'm a big fan of hers.
Excellent organization. I do a lot of interviews with those people.
They work very hard. The labor movement and the Canadian Labor Congress is very strong on this issue as well. So there's a number of different places where people can get involved. My essential message is you have to get involved.
That's right.
Because the future of our country and our ability to make these decisions as citizens of a democratic country, these are the kinds of things that are at stake. And little by little, as each one of these trade agreements is signed, it's reducing the scope of action of government and the scope of ability and choices that we have as citizens.
Well, the government is not acting on behalf of its citizens, and that's obvious. People first have to understand what is really going on, and it's basically, a lot of people just get bored with it. I've talked to other politicians, even locally, that said, well, I don't understand this issue because we have reams and reams of papers and reports to read through. Well, that's a lobbyist ploy. When they start throwing reams of paperwork and study work that they've done at the politician, and they have to address something at some point, you know, that's how they keep out of the loop. They keep uninformed by keeping busy reading planned reports. I'm so tired of reports that have been sent out to some third-party person. They sort of look like a little template themselves. I wanted to ask about Obama, because he did promise to do something about NAFTA. And I want to talk about the U.S. steelworkers, because they're involved here, if you could.
Well, U.S. steelworkers are, as with Canadian steelworkers, very effective on these issues. They do tremendous work, both within the union and out in the general public. And so they, I think, are part of leading the fight towards a fair trade model for international trade and a much more balanced approach on these trade and economic issues. Obama is, I think, very clearly to my mind, what President Obama got as a message in the midterm elections was that he has to start responding to the folks that got him elected in the first place. He got elected with a broad citizens' coalition, a movement, the labor movement, environmentalists.
Same people we're talking about.
A rainbow coalition, yes. And
yeah.
And he promptly got taken over by the same sort of political advisors that always push to the right. And so what happened is, in the midterm elections, the people that brought him to power didn't go out to vote. They just didn't go out to vote. And what's fascinating, when you look at the composition of the Democratic Senate and Congress, the fair trading progressive Democrats were reelected. The right-wing Democrats that are so-called free traders that don't really understand trade and economic policy, they were defeated by often fair trade or anti-free trade Tea Party activists.
Right.
So what we actually have in the U.S. Congress now is greater concern around trade agreements than ever before. And it's because President Obama largely took on the Bush trade agenda that I think he's suffering this public backlash. People who do go out to vote saying, well, no, we're not going to have these mealy-mouthed words anymore. We want very clear fair trade policy. And at the same time, a lot of his base saying, you know, it's just not worth it. You're not being progressive enough, President Obama, so we're not going to go out and vote for you this year. And it's funny, when you watch the television, the right-wing media pundits, as they always do, say, oh, no, he's got to move more to the right. It's absurd. What he actually needs to do is be much more progressive, be much more balanced in his approach, and stop listening to corporate lobbyists and start listening to the public. Hopefully he'll heed that message.
I wonder what position he really is in. Can he make that decision?
Yeah. And that's I think... that's the message that he has to contradict, stop this sense that he's under the control of lobbyists, and start being much more courageous and much more progressive in how he's approaching this kind of work. And he supported, you mentioned the steelworkers earlier, Maggie, you're absolutely right. I mean, Leo Gerard is the international president, and we've got Ken Newman here, the national director in Canada. I mean, these are very progressive individuals. The steelworkers themselves are a very progressive organization, terrific labor activists. They're people who really care about Canada, really care about the community, whether we're talking about Hamilton or any other community they're part of across the country. And these are the kinds of people that are saying, you know, you have to be progressive in these approaches, and we're with you. And President Obama, if he takes that much more progressive stand, there'll be a lot of allies out there working with him, and most importantly, he'll re-galvanize that base that elected him in the first place and chose not to vote this fall. He needs to get those younger people out, African Americans, Hispanic Americans that were out and involved 2 years ago and are waiting to get that clear signal from him. And hopefully he'll be providing that signal and be moving them to get back involved in the political system. Because it's the same dynamic in Canada as it is in the United States. Younger people, poorer people, are not voting. And they're not voting if they don't get that compelling vision. Mm-hmm. Now, fortunately in Hamilton, I think we've got, with the three terrific MPs that I mentioned earlier, what we've got is, I think, something that change that people can believe in. As New Democrats, we're trying to do across the country is get the kind of strong candidates that provide that progressive vision of the country and the sense that what we really need is a fair trade agenda, a trade template that really mirrors where most Canadians are, rather than this hard right market fundamentalist line that liberals and
we have to explain, as you've done. And just expose exactly what these deals are, who's getting the money from the deals, why there's so much unemployment. And there's so many poverty rallies here in Hamilton. I'm really quite proud of the grassroots. I mean, these are people that are living in very dire straits as a result. They're out there in the freezing temperatures. The union comes, the NDP come. They always help and support the poor. There's a tight ball of the people that you can lean on, and they bring their various things together, and they have terrific rallies, but nobody seems to want to listen. The last one that they had on the special diet, they rallied out in front of City Hall. City Hall made sure that they stood as far away from the city building as possible because they didn't want their staff disturbed. And here's this whole plaza area in front of City Hall that was purposely designed so that people could participate and say their town hall speeches right in front of the City Hall, and it's not being used. It's just this kind of little attitude of push them away, push them out of sight, keep those kinds of protesters down. Don't recognize this kind of element that we're up against.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Maggie, before I go, I just wanted to mention, for folks who are concerned about the Canada-European Trade Agreement, they want to get involved, they can contact the local members of Parliament. There's Chris Charlton in Hamilton Mountain and David Christofferson in Hamilton Centre, and, of course, Wayne Marston in Hamilton East Stony Creek. And there's also the Trade Justice Network, and the Trade Justice Network people can reach with by www.tradejustice.ca. Or they can go on my website, peterjulian.ca. So there's lots of, if folks want to follow up, who've heard your excellent broadcast today, and thank you very much for having me on the program.
They just need to know where they can go and join others, and so that they've gotten over that. It's not just me. I can stand up if I want.
There's many ways they can follow up, either through their local MP or through my office or through the Trade Justice Commission.
Thanks so much today for your time and explaining that. I hope that will make people or allow people to understand a little bit more about what's going on with these trade deals. We hear this little soundbite on TV, and yet we're still losing jobs in Hamilton or wherever you are in Canada, still losing jobs. Are you the International Trade Critics, Peter?
Yes, I am. International Trade Critic for the NDP and the MP for Burnaby, New Westminster, and BC.
You are listening to The Other Side of the News on 93.3 CFMU-FM.
And I have to point out one thing that you probably already know. The most active province to do with things that we were just talking about is BC. Tremendously strong grassroots groups out there.
We certainly do, as so does the Hamilton region, and it's all of us working together that's going to bring the kind of change to Canadian trade policy that we need. Our trade policy is profoundly dysfunctional and does a disservice to most Canadians. We need to change that.
And it's been like that since the 1980s. It's too long.
Yeah. So, season's greetings to all your listeners, and thanks very much, Maggie. Thanks for your great program.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Peter Julian has a right to feel proud about what the NDP is doing on a federal level and grassroots-wise on a provincial level. Here's a bit from the special diet rally that happened last November the 26th. Myself and some other speakers pointed out the reality of some of the politics and the policy changes.
Okay, I'm going to call up Maggie Hughes. She is a who's affected by the cuts in the special diet, and she's a well-known activist in the city.
Yeah.
Are you all freezing out here?
Yeah.
I can't imagine staying outside tonight.
No.
Would you survive it?
No.
That's called domicile. When the government purposely puts its people in a position where they cannot find shelter, and they cannot provide food for themselves. That's called domicile. There's another thing I wanted to talk about. I mean, I know I was asked to come here today to represent the 100,000 people living in poverty. I have two diseases. I didn't choose to be poor. I didn't choose to be on disability. It just happened because I got sick. I had a great job. I loved it. I rubbed elbows with musicians and actors and politicians, and you know, that's what I got to see behind the curtain, as Paul calls it. I saw a lot of stuff going down in the beginning of the 1980s, and that was when this market fundamentalism started. And that changed the focus of all our economic policies. We are the victims of global economic policies. That's what's happening here and all over the world. This kind of stuff is going on all over the world, but a handful of people make triple-digit millionaires. And there's people making $54, $53 billion a year. What is the point? The market is out of balance, and it's out of balance by greed. It's done purposefully. When we start to allow foreign companies to come into our country and to dictate to our labor and to take our resources and pollute the air, the water, and the land, we get sick. A lot of our diseases are because of pollution to our food, to our water, and to our air. I have MS. I also have fibromyalgia, and that's a hell of a disease that everybody wants to ignore. These are autoimmune diseases. They are caused by pollution. I just want to wrap up with one thing. You have to inform yourself. And we are informed, but we can't keep knocking at the same door. You have to realize that it is the federal government and their economic policies. It's a mindset that is wrong. I suggest anybody who wants to know more about this, read up on George Soros. George Soros, S-O-R-O-S. And he will fill you in on what's been going on. That's the guy that made the stock market, and it made him rich. He said, I've got enough, and he started to give back. And when he investigated what was going wrong with the numbers of poverty, he came up with that theory of market fundamentalism. We have to fight for Canada. I don't know if we've lost it yet. I hope not. But we have to take this country back. I used to be proud of Canada, and I'm sorry, I am no longer proud of this country ever since people like Harper got in. I can't be proud of a country that ignores its masses and sells dirty oil and keeps burning fossil fuel while more people become sick because of that greed. We have to be aware of what we're dealing with, corporate greed. That's about it.
Thank you very much, Maggie. Now I'm going to call up one of our fellow members, Joseph St. George, and he's going to say a few words as well.
All right, thank you very much, Michelle. First, everybody, stomp your feet. If your feet are cold, stomp your feet. And if your hands are cold, clap your hands. And if you want to get even warmer, wave your hands in the air so the police think we're starting a riot. Never mind about special diet. Let's have special riot. If we keep on going the way we are, everybody out there, anybody looking out the windows, if they can hear us, we are not strong activists to the degree of violence. I'd like to thank the Hamilton Police for escorting us over here and guiding us, but also I want to thank good man Paul Miller for taking our petitions into the government. The governments don't listen to us unless we take to the streets. So even though the call has blocked some of us, there's people like Maggie Hughes who've turned out. You don't realize how much of an effort it is for her to get up in the morning and get together and get out to something like this. Big round of applause for Maggie. Yeah. She and the other people that are here are representative of what the government ignorance and I can't use proper nice words, but what they are doing to us. More of us, if we demonstrate, hit the streets, show a little bit of riot and ruckus, maybe we'll be listened to more. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. A winner this from the Registered Nursing Association. Here's the mic to Dan.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Jan Glancy now. I'm here on the 30th of October. I'm a registered nurse and I'm the co-chair of the Hamilton chapter of the Registered Nurses Association. And I want to thank the campaign of adequate welfare and disability benefits for organizing us today and bringing attention to this life and death matter. Daily in our nursing practice, we see people suffering illnesses from poverty. Evidence goes towards all of this kind of thing to say that adequate nutrition and proper housing makes a huge difference in your health. People that don't have these things die in excess of 21 years earlier than people that do have adequate income and adequate nutrition. So we've all seen the Code Red series. That is evidence that this is actually the truth. This is not something we've dreamed up. This is the truth. 21 years in difference is a huge amount of life expectancy that's lost because of poverty. The primary difference between what you folks put up with and what folks put up with just an adequate income is huge in amount of health. So all we want is a living wage. I will tell you that we will be campaigning on your behalf over the next year, and we will be present at the Queen's Park in order to make sure that the Registered Nurses Association supports all the things that you stand for.
There's another research group on the web called Climate Action Network. They do a lot of behind-the-scenes digging and looking, and the executive director is Graham Saul. He wrote a recent article in April talking about how Prime Minister Stephen Harper is trying to make the European Union downsize their environmental protection bills, trying to get them to change their greenhouse laws, basically trying to get them to undermine their Climate Protection Act. We caught Mr. Saul en route to another engagement and had a brief conversation.
The European Union is trying to adopt legislation and regulations that would lower the greenhouse gas content of fuels, transportation fuels. So they're trying to clean up their transportation fuels. And the Canadian government is lobbying the European Union to adopt regulations that in fact would weaken the spirit and intention of the transportation fuels. Specifically, they're lobbying the European Union to ignore the fact that tar sands fuel is more carbon intensive, is more of a greenhouse gas pollutant than other forms of fuel.
So that's pretty blatant. It's pretty obvious.
It's scandalous. With the government, not only is the government of Canada doing nothing of substance at home to deal with this problem, but it's actively going into other people's countries and lobbying to weaken perfectly good climate change policy in order to protect the interests of oil corporations.
And would that be because Harper is hoping to sell that very oil to the European Union members?
No, it would be because the entire climate and energy policy of the Harper government is based around catering to the interests of oil companies, whether it's the international climate change negotiations or the failure to take any meaningful action domestically, or this most egregious example of actually trying to weaken legislation in other jurisdictions. It's all consistent with a pattern, which is to do as little as possible to actually deal with the problem and then to actively promote the interests of oil companies rather than people on the planet.
He is lobbying with the oil companies. Is there any examples of that I can find?
Well, you can find on our website associated with that particular article, you can find evidence that the government of Canada is going in and having meetings and intervening in European policy formulation on behalf of measures that effectively favor the oil corporations active in the tar sands.
Right.
That they're proposing and intervening on policy that would effectively weaken, or they're proposing and intervening on issues that, if adopted, would effectively weaken the climate change, the clean energy policy or clean transportation fuels policy of the European Union. You can find, I think, similar evidence regarding the low-carbon fuel standard in California, where there were letters from the Canadian ambassador in the United States and the Minister of Natural Resources, I believe, to Governor Schwarzenegger, basically thinly veiled threats that if they went forward with adopting a low-carbon fuel standard that differentiated between the relatively high pollution of tar sands oil in comparison to conventional oil, they would use whatever international trade provisions they had to challenge those. So they basically threatened the California government with taking them to tribunal or court, whatever the proper term for the international trade mechanisms are. And then finally, I think if you were to look for information regarding how the government has responded to various different provisions in the congressional climate change bill that came out of the U.S. Congress, especially those provisions that specifically involve transportation fuels, I think you'd find further evidence that that they've been working to weaken policy that might in any way hold the tar sands accountable for their higher greenhouse gas pollution.
Right, and at the same time, they are removing anything to do with environment information, environment media.
Yeah, they're in the process of also stripping the environment assessment policies of certain provisions that will result in weaker oversight during the preparation phase of key projects.
Right, so what can we do about that? I mean, your site is the first place I've heard about this, and I follow this stuff fairly closely.
Well, we need to make sure Canadians understand this. This isn't what, Canadians don't like the idea of our government running around the world undermining perfectly good climate change policy in order to protect oil companies. So what we're trying to do is make sure that a broader range of Canadians understand that this is happening, and then to get them to apply pressure on their elected officials to stop the process. At the same time, the Canadian government and the Alberta government are putting significant amounts of resources into public relations for the tar sands in other countries. I believe, in fact, the Environment Minister of Alberta is currently planning a tour of a number of capitals in Europe and has the audacity to suggest it's about promoting clean energy.
Yeah, well, BP was saying the same thing, too. Now look where they are.
Right.
Where else do you suggest they look? And my concern is that a lot of them might not be able to get on the computer, which is where most of the information lays.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't an issue that's being actively covered in the mainstream press. I know the CanWest newspapers have covered it on occasion, and other newspapers do on the day-to-day basis. If they're not in a position to get onto the Internet and Google for different tar sands websites, which I know there's a number of organizations that have set up broad websites on issues related to the tar sands.
It's called the social media, but it's really removing a whole sector of our society based on income. How long has that organization been going, Graham?
Oh, in one form or another for more than 20 years, but we've only been legally incorporated for about 8 or 9.
And that was CEO Graham Saul from Climate Action Network. That would be a very good organization for anybody that's interested in trying to get involved. Go to their Climate Action Network website, and you will see an activity section on the right-hand side. This has been The Other Side of the News, and thanks for listening. Find Radio.
Radio.